It is true that an estimated 25 to 50% of rattlesnake bites are dry, and that means that the snake chooses not to use their venom.
It would have been a wet bite. I'm just saying. I think it would have been a wet bite.
You think so?
Yeah, uh-huh. I would have died. Uh-huh.
A wet bite by a 6-foot snake, and you would have died.
By a very venomous snake.
Very large.
Venomous snake.
All right. Welcome to the Dear Bob and Sue podcast, stories from our journey to all 63 U.S. national parks and other spectacular public lands. I'm Karen Smith.
And I'm Matt Smith. We're the authors of the Dear Bob and Sue series of books. This is our monthly mailbag episode where we answer questions from listeners about the national parks, road trips, camping, gear, and a variety of other travel-related topics.
Today, we'll be giving some recommendations about things to do in Guadalupe Mountains National Park, as well as some tips about how to avoid altitude sickness in the higher elevation parks.
We'll discuss common mistakes that people make when planning their national park trips. Plus, we'll offer some advice to a listener about how to navigate retirement. Her husband's retirement, that is.
All this and more coming up next.
So Karen, before we get into the episode, do you have any park news?
You look so hopeful when you said that.
I am. This is where I get all my park news.
Well, it's kind of park news, yes, but I have a new title for it. We're going to call this segment, What's Closed This Summer?
Oh, yeah. I hope that's not going to be a segment that keeps getting repeated.
I know. It seems like there are a lot of closures, and so we thought we would just talk about some of them in case anyone out there is unaware.
Okay, but let's make this peppy and exciting.
Okay.
So for the audience.
So it's not Debbie Downer, all this stuff is closed.
Or Karen Downer, no.
Right. All right, now the biggest one, and this hits close to home because we're planning to go this summer, is Wind Cave National Park in South Dakota. The park is not closing, but unfortunately, all of the tours will be shut down.
Yeah, that's too bad because the tours of the cave, even though I'm not a cave guy, are pretty cool. But we talked to a ranger there recently, and he explained it to us. And I guess once you realize they're putting elevators down deep, deep into the ground with a lot of humidity and just the elevator mechanisms, they just don't like all that humidity. So they've been having a lot of elevator service disruptions. So they just have to do it.
Right. They have to replace the elevators. So they will be shutting down the tours this summer, starting May 1st, actually. Not sure when they'll resume, hopefully sometime in the fall. But for all of you folks going this summer, they will not be available, unfortunately. Now, as I said, the park is still open, and we would certainly encourage people who are visiting the Black Hills to go through Wind Cave National Park.
It's almost like a hidden gem. The hiking in Wind Cave National Park is really great. I mean, the landscape is cool and interesting by itself, but there are a lot of bison in the park, and a lot of times they're back in the trees and back in the park where people can't see them from the road. And if you hike back on one of the trails, you have a good chance of seeing some bison, which is what happened to us. And that was really cool.
Yes. And that's one of the biggest draws, I think, of Wind Cave, besides the cave itself, are the bison.
Yeah.
The last time we were there, we had some great bison sightings. There were a ton of them by the visitor center. So definitely go and check out the visitor center. They're going to have some new displays this summer. Your kiddos can still get the Junior Ranger badge, of course, or anyone can get the Junior Ranger badge.
You
don't
could.
Have to be a kid.
No.
But yeah, still visit Wind Cave, even though sadly the tours won't be running.
Yeah, so that's one thing that'll be closed. What else you got, Karen?
Well, for folks visiting Mesa Verde in Southwest Colorado, they are closing the Wetherill Mesa for construction. And so one of the most popular tours is up there, and that's the Longhouse Tour. So the Longhouse Tour will not be available in 2024. We are going to Mesa Verde, and I was looking forward to doing that one. So that one is off our list and everyone's list.
Right. That's a big chunk of the park, though, the Wetherill Mesa.
Oh, yes. And it's a beautiful part of the park.
Yeah. But this is the issue, right? I mean, they have to maintain these parks. They get a lot of use. And so from time to time, they're going to have to close areas to do whatever maintenance they need to do.
Well, exactly. And the next one is the same thing. So this is Capitol Reef National Park in Utah. The park will be closing the beautiful scenic drive for construction. Now, if you've driven back there, you know that the road, which was built many, many, many decades ago, I believe in the 60s, the road has a couple of dips down, and every time a flash flood comes through there, it sweeps across the road, makes travel impassable, puts all kinds of debris on the road. So they're actually fixing the road, doing a lot of changes, and also to, I think, some of the parking areas back there.
What are they doing, culverts? So that the water rushes underneath the road, do you know?
You know, Matt, they didn't tell me that. They didn't. They didn't share that information.
Right. I thought this was the park news segment of the episode, but...
Now, the plans are still fluid for this one. They don't have a contract yet for this construction project. They think it's going to be awarded in April, at which time more details will be available, but... They anticipate starting it in April and having it closed sometime, probably through October of 2024.
That is too bad. That's one of my favorite scenic drives in all the national parks.
Yes, but the good news, Matt, there is good news on this one. They're closing it past the Fruita District, so visitors can still access the campground, the visitor center, and most importantly, the Gifford House and those pies that you can buy at
the
Gifford House.
You can buy a pie.
Yes, you can still buy pies.
That would be, if they close the pie store, that would be a problem.
That would be the end of the world as we know it.
Yeah. And another thing we should mention about this closure is some of the trails that are very popular back off of the scenic road, you can get to from the backside. Of the park.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is a way probably to get to some of those popular hikes. It might add some distance, but I think you can hike down some washes from another road to get to those.
Yeah. And that, like that Cassidy Arch that we did, which is a great hike, you can also access that from the Fruita District, you know, kind of by where that big old barn is. So yes, definitely check with the rangers at the visitor center to see what you can still hike in that area.
Well, that's not too bad. Just a couple of park closures.
Well, no, we're not done yet. All right. In Sequoia National Park, Crystal Cave will be closed in 2024. Apparently, the road to the cave, the trail, and the visitor facilities back there suffered a lot of damage from the fire that came through a few years ago and a recent heavy snowstorm, so they have to repair all of that.
Well, we're not cave people, so that won't affect our travel plans.
I would like to see Crystal Cave. That's been in my bucket for a while, so we'll just have to maybe put that on the list for 2025.
Okay.
All right. Now, some old news from Denali National Park in Alaska.
Old bad news?
This is old, continuing bad news. And this is the closure of the Denali Park Road at mile 43. Now, you know, it's been closed, I think, for, I don't know, maybe two summers now. And I think they had hopes at the beginning that they could do a little bypass. Wait, so let's go back. There was a rock slide that closed the road.
A big rock slide.
A huge rock slide that closed the road. And so they're basically not just fixing that, but kind of rerouting that area so that it doesn't keep happening. Now, they had hoped initially that they could do a little bypass while this construction was going on and get people all the way back in the park again. But unfortunately, that's not going to happen. And so the road past mile 43 will continue to be closed through summer of 2026.
So another couple years.
Yes. That's a long time.
That is. But again, they've got to do that. Or, you know, if they don't fix these things well, these closures are going to just keep happening. So, you know, it is good that they're taking the time to engineer it so that I'm guessing it's not susceptible to these kinds of rock slides in the future.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, if you're visiting Denali, obviously the bus tours are still running. They'll go to mile 43 or 42 maybe, yeah. Before they have to turn around. So that's still a good chunk. I know if you want to, you could also do flight seeing. I know that for those couple of backcountry lodges that are at the very end of the road, they're now flying people in. So, you know, you just have to make some adjustments. But you know what's cool, Matt, is just imagine what the wildlife must be doing back there now that there are no buses.
They're having a party.
I know. So it would be pretty cool to see.
Okay, so that's Denali. You also have something here about Everglades National Park.
Right. If you're visiting the Gulf Coast in Everglades City, all the visitor facilities will be closed to the public starting on April 1st. They are building a new visitor center called the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Visitor Center. So they're closing the area for, you know, visitor safety. And that includes stuff like the canoe and kayak launch, all the parking areas, the visitor contact station. All that will be closed.
Okay, well, that's starting April 1st. So hopefully the warmer weather, they would get fewer visitors anyway. So they got to do that to build a new visitor center. We also have some news about North Cascades National Park.
Right. Now, this is near and dear to our hearts. If you listened to our episode number 123, we talked about our trip back to this little remote community called Stehekin, which you can only access from a boat, a plane, or if you want to hike in. So it's this remote part of the park. And sadly, there is a visitor center back there called the Golden West Visitor Center that they're closing down this summer. It won't be opening due to a lack of staff.
Oh, that's the only reason they're closing it? Is lack of staff?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You didn't volunteer to woman the visitor center during the summer? They would give you a ranger outfit. They might even let you write tickets.
I know.
They won't give you a gun.
No.
That's never going to happen.
That is actually kind of tempting. There was a great big brouhaha, is that the right word I'm looking for? Here in Washington State, when people found out that it was going to be closed, and there were petitions that were sent to the Department of the Interior to open this up, but the NPS said the problem is they just don't have the employees to staff it. I guess they lost a couple of employees, and it's tough to attract and retain people.
Because the job sucks.
No, I don't think the job sucks.
Because visitors complain to them all the time.
I think it's because it's such a remote location.
Yeah, it could be. So yeah, people are willing to sign a petition, but no one's willing to volunteer.
Right. Also, apparently the park budgets are not keeping up with inflation. And for North Cascades, their overall staff has decreased 28%. Due to funding challenges.
So that's also the issue. The pay's probably not great.
Right.
So you got to live in this remote area, not get paid a lot. Mm-hmm. That now makes more sense.
So I read that this visitor center gets about 11,000 visitors a year. And of course, that would be in the summer because this visitor center is only open in the summer. One of the least visited visitor centers out there. And so, you know, they're pulling their staff to go to the big visitor center, the big North Cascades one that's near New Halem. So anyway, so that's the news out of North Cascades. They did say, however, if you're visiting, you know, they're going to have the box of brochures out in front and the park stamp and information like that. So, you know, you will
they're
be
just leaving the stamp outside.
I'm sure it's going to be chained to the building.
That's going to be chained. Okay, so that's that. And then also the Chilkoot Trail. So this is part of the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park. They have a visitor center both in downtown Seattle and also in Skagway, Alaska. And then, of course, the trail itself is part of the National Historical Park. So, Karen, what news do we have about the Chilkoot Trail?
Well, you know, sadly, it's closed again on the U.S. side. So if you're not familiar with this, the Chilkoot Trail itself is 33 miles long, and it runs through both the United States and Canada. Now, this trail was part of the route that the gold seekers took up to the Klondike in the late 1800s. And now it's a recreational trail that people hike and backpack. So what's happened is they have just had a lot of flooding over the last couple of years. And so last summer, the U.S. side wasn't open at all. Now they have fixed the first 4 miles of the trail. So you can hike to mile four, turn around and hike back out. It's for day use only, so you cannot camp there.
Yeah, we were there during some of that flooding.
Oh my gosh, it's been wild.
It was wild when we were there. They closed the trail both in front of us and behind us. We were trapped like beavers for a day.
I know. So this was back in August of 2018, and we did a podcast episode about this experience. It was way, way back at the beginning of our podcast series. It was number 12. But yeah, we did 2 days of hiking and camping. And then when we woke up on our third day, that was the hardest day, where you have to go up the Golden Staircase and go over the pass. And that's where you cross into Canada.
Yeah, very dramatic. We got up that day. It rained, well, starting the night before when we got into our tents. And the downpour literally did not stop all night long. Our tent had about an inch of standing water at the bottom of it. The only reason we weren't sleeping in water is because we had inflatable sleeping pads. Mm-hmm. And so we were like on little floaties.
Yes.
In the water. So that was the beginning. So we get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, soaking wet, have to pack up everything in a downpour, literally squeeze the water out of our backpacks. And that was the day we were going to head up over the Golden Staircase.
That's right. And we were doing this with our friends, John and Lolly. And so we set off. The ranger that's stationed there at this camp where we had spent the night told everyone, you need to be on the trail by 6 a.m. because you have such a long day ahead of you. And it's so difficult that you have to get to your next campsite before it gets dark, obviously. So everyone start out at 6 a.m. So we're up in the dark. We have our headlamps. We start out and we get to a point. We hiked a couple of miles. I don't know, maybe 3-ish miles. And we get to almost the bottom of this staircase. And the ranger had said, you know, there's a small creek crossing. You'll go across before you hit the staircase. Because of the rain, this little creek crossing was a raging river.
It was one of the scariest moments we've had on our national park trips. I've never seen so much water coming down off of the mountains. We looked at this mountain ridge. Every maybe 100 yards, there was a new waterfall forming. Mm-hmm. I mean, there must have been 20 waterfalls coming off that mountain, at like big ones.
Well, yeah. And then we could see that this new river that had formed as it went down the hill, so to speak, it swept into the huge river. Was that the Taya River?
I think, yeah.
Anyway, it would be instant death if you were swept away. So, you know, to make a long story short, we hung around there for about 45 minutes. We walked up and down to see if there was an easier place to cross. Maybe there would be rocks or something and we could get across. There was no way that we could see. And by this time, you know, it's 40-some degrees and we're soaked to the skin. I was starting to lose it.
We were starting to lose it. Yeah. And we were getting a little concerned because the river crossing was becoming not as big of a problem as hypothermia. And so we headed back down to the camp because there was a shelter there that we could get under a roof. With all of this rain, and then we heard all this thunder, but we couldn't see lightning, and we realized it wasn't thunder. It was the boulders in the river tumbling down the river. Yeah. Car-sized boulders.
Right,
these
right.
were huge boulders. So it was pretty apocalyptic at that point. So we got out of there. We hiked back down to camp.
Right. And then because you have to reserve your campsites ahead of time, it wasn't like we could spend one more day back at that camp and then continue the next day because we didn't have reservations for these very small camps. So long story short, we ended up hiking back out the way we came in back to Skagway. So we only did half of the Chilkoot Trail. So all that being said, we have wanted to go back ever since and complete it because it feels like unfinished business. Now, the mistake we made was we should have gone back in 2019, the next year, but who would have foreseen what would happen?
Well, yeah, 2019 would have been the perfect time, although we couldn't pull the trigger.
We needed a little more time to forget.
We needed that memory to go away. And then we were ready to go. 2020, we had everything already we had the permits, we were going, we were going to conquer this trail, and then COVID hits.
And yeah, and everything was shut down. Now, just to give you some idea of the logistics of this that we went through to arrange the trip. So this was in January of 2020. So you have to call Parks Canada to get the camping permits, and you have to talk to the ranger in person.
There's no online. This is literally call a phone, listen to it ring. Maybe they'll answer the phone. Now, I'm not criticizing them because they, like, everyone's calling right at the exact moment that the permits go up. You leave a message on the answering machine, and then they call you back. They speak in French until you tell them that, you know, you're a dumb American, you can only speak English.
Right. And it's recommended that you camp for 4 nights, you know, 33 miles, 4 nights. So you have to line up all these campsites and make sure, you know, they're each available on the night you want. Then we had to book the flights to and from Juneau, because the only way to get to Skagway is by small airplane, float plane. We didn't want to do that. So we flew in and out of Juneau, and then we had to get boat tickets for a boat to take us to and from Skagway. We had to line up the train out of Lake Bennett, because when you finish this hike, this 33 miles, you are in Lake Bennett and you have to get back to Skagway. So there's a train.
Yeah, it's not a loop.
It's not a loop. There's a train that will take you back, but the train only runs on certain days. Right. The hiker train.
Right, the hiker train. I don't know what hikers do on those other days. They must just sit around and look at each other until the train comes.
Right. And then we had to book hotels in Skagway for the first night, you know, before we set off, and then the night we came back. So tons of logistics. We literally had everything lined up, ready to go. And then in March, when COVID hit, everything shut down and they closed it all. And then, of course, the next year, the Canadian border was still closed. You could not cross the border on this trail. And then the flooding started, and it's been closed ever since. And so that's where we are. And I don't know when we'll get back to finish this quest.
Yeah, who knows how long it's going to be before this opens back up. Anyway, so I know this is a popular trail for people who seek adventure. It's on a lot of people's lists. Mm-hmm. We would encourage people to do it. However, who knows when it's going to be available?
Well, right, because bridges were literally washed away, so they have to rebuild bridges, which, you know, isn't a simple thing.
Okay. All right, Karen, this has turned into an entire episode of What's Closed This Summer.
All right, we are done with that. Let's move on to mailbag, shall we?
Yeah, do we have any questions?
We do. The first question comes from Cassandra in Buffalo Grove, Illinois.
I don't know where Buffalo Grove is, but did Cassandra's question get moved to the top of the list because she lives in a town with Buffalo in the name?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yes. And by the way, it's a suburb of Chicago. I looked it up.
Okay.
Okay. And she wrote, "Dear Matt and Karen, I'm going to be in Guadalupe Mountains National Park for one day during my trip to Carlsbad Caverns and White Sands. I couldn't find an episode where you talk about the park. What shouldn't I miss, and which hiking trail do you recommend?"
Yeah, we get that question every now and then, don't we? A few mm-hmm. times a year. Are hiking recommendations for GM?
That's right. I think we talked about it one time in an episode where someone asked us if we had ever encountered a rattlesnake. Oh,
yes, we did. So we talked about, do we want to talk about the snake?
Yes, Matt. I think this will be another great opportunity for you to share your story about the rattlesnake, the story that keeps getting bigger and bigger with every telling.
I almost died.
I know. I'm sorry I'm laughing. It's not funny that you almost died. It's just that it is funny how the story kind of grows in epicness.
You don't want to hear the story again. Did I tell you about that time I stepped on a rattlesnake, Karen? And I almost died?
Okay, Matt, let's save that for a few minutes when we talk about Guadalupe Peak.
Okay.
Okay, so we have been to this park twice. Once was in late October and once was in late May. So we kind of had two different weather experiences, and it was fun to see it in, you know, both seasons, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. The entire park has more than 86,000 acres, but the developed area is a small section on the south side of the park, and it's just off of Highway 62 or 180. That's the same highway that runs kind of back and forth to Carlsbad Caverns. I think it also extends west to El Paso.
Right. So it's very convenient that probably where you want to go is literally on your way to or from Carlsbad. And the Pine Springs Visitor Center is in this main area. So you can, you know, hit the Visitor Center, of course. And there are about a half a dozen trails that take off from this area. One that we have done is Guadalupe Peak, and there is another one that we keep hearing about that people think is really fun, and that's Devil's Hall. But Matt, let's talk about Guadalupe Peak first.
Guadalupe Peak is, I think, probably the most popular trail in the park. It takes you to the top of, obviously, Guadalupe Peak, which is the highest point in the state of Texas. It's 8,751 feet, which, by the way, is taller, is higher in elevation than the highest point of Olympic National Park here in the Pacific Northwest, which is very mountainous. So you don't realize it until you look at the elevations, like you're pretty far up there.
Yes.
Yeah, and you're in Texas.
Now, the Guadalupe Peak hike is listed as very strenuous. It's about 8.5 miles round trip. It has 3,000 feet of elevation gain. And what I remember about it, well, a couple things we'll get to, but it's not technical in any way. It's just kind of a slog. It's just kind of a steep slog up. And it seems like it's always windy.
I think it is. We've heard that. It was mm-hmm. very windy mm-hmm. when we were there. Make sure you take sunglasses or goggles because the dust and sand will get into your eyes. It was a tough hike up there. There's a pretty large, flat, scrabble area of rocks at the top. So there were several other hikers up there, but there's enough space like you can spread out and, mm-hmm. and have lunch. There's also an interesting historic marker up there.
Right. People get their picture taken with that marker, including us. It's kind yeah. of a cool thing to do. But what was most memorable for us was on the way back down. And again, we were with our friends, John and Lolly. But on our way back down, Matt was in the lead of the four of us on the trail. And as I was, you know, walking behind him and kind of watching him, all of a sudden I noticed that he stopped and kind of did this backwards dancing movement.
I started dancing. I started dancing, which I could imagine would be an odd sight. Yeah, we were pretty tired. And this was maybe halfway down the mountain. So we'd climbed all the way up. We're halfway down. I was just in a daze, one foot in front of the next. And I'm not sure if the rattlesnake was on the trail and I stepped on it, or it crawled in front of me and I stepped on it. I kind of think it darted out in front of me. I'm going to say it darted out in front of me. But
we'll go with that.
But somehow one of my feet ended up on like the back third of this rattlesnake. And as soon as I put my foot down, the snake got mad. And the rattle was going. Mm. And so that's when I took my foot off trying to, you know, like dance around so we didn't have a good target. But we were on this leg. Mm. So there's a steep drop off on one side, and then there was a cliff on the other that was straight up. So it just went right like 3 feet away against the cliff and just coiled there. There's a little tiny bush it went under. But we still then had to go past him to get back down the trail.
And John got down on his hands and knees so he could peer under the bush. And he was making fun of you because it appeared to him and to the rest of us that it might have been a little baby snake.
Okay. You know, Karen, I think the story gets smaller and smaller every time you tell it. Okay, it was coiled up and it wasn't a baby. It was a full-grown black-tailed rattlesnake, and they're very venomous. So, yeah. And then second of all, I stepped on it and I almost died. Did I tell you that part?
Well, how long was it, Matt?
Well, it was, I don't know, 4 feet, maybe 3 feet. It doesn't matter how big it was. It's a very venomous snake. I almost died, and yeah.
Okay. All right. Continue.
Then when we got to the visitor center, we told the ranger. We went in the diorama of the park with the different stuffed animals, and I pointed out which one it was, because it was green with a black rattle. And he goes, oh, that's the most venomous snake we have in the park. Mm-hmm. He goes, it would have been really bad had it bitten you. So we had this discussion about what I should have done if a snake had bitten me. And he said, the best thing to do is to stay put and then send somebody down to the visitor center for help. And then they would call a doctor in El Paso and have him fly via helicopter because the rangers are not allowed to administer anti-venom. And I'm doing the math of how long that all would take. Yeah, he said, it's not a good situation to be in.
Well, right. And I said something like, so Matt would have been a goner. And he said, well, I don't know about that, but he would have at least lost his leg over that. So a little sobering, Cassandra. Definitely watch for snakes on the trail.
But if you don't step on them.
Yeah.
I think it's okay.
Yeah, as long as you don't step on them.
And rattlesnakes give you a warning. I mean, they rattle. And well, in all seriousness, most rattlesnake bites occur from the elbow down.
Yeah.
Because people are messing with them.
And another thing, and I really don't mean to diminish your epic story.
Go right ahead. But you will anyway.
But it is true that an estimated 25 to 50% of rattlesnake bites are dry. And that means that the snake chooses not to use their venom. And the reason is, do you know why this is, Matt?
It would have been a wet bite. I'm just saying. I don't know.
And you almost died. I know. Okay. Yes. And it was 10 feet long. Okay. But I guess it takes the average rattlesnake 3 weeks to replenish the venom once they inject someone with it. And because their venom is intended to immobilize prey, and then they eat that prey, if they use their venom on something that they can't eat, that means that they won't be able to eat for a couple of weeks. So that's why rattlesnakes do everything they can to avoid unnecessarily using their venom on like a human.
What if it's pissed off because I stepped on it? I think it would have been a wet bite.
You think so?
Yeah, uh-huh. I would have died. Uh-huh.
A wet bite by a 6-foot snake, and you would have died.
By a very venomous snake.
Very large.
Venomous snake.
All right. Okay, so that's the rattlesnake issue there. Now, the other hike I mentioned is called Devil's Haul. This one is 4.2 miles round trip. And I guess what's cool about this one is that after the first mile or so, you go through this rocky wash, which takes you then to this natural rock staircase. And then you go through this hallway that's formed by these steep canyon walls. It looks pretty cool. Now, the park rates this as strenuous. And what's interesting, when I just looked on the park website, they have this hike in red, warning people that it is very strenuous. So I don't know if they've had some rescues out there or what. So just note that this one is not a beginner hike.
And it has devil in its name.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of scary.
And about a mile east, further on the highway, is the Frijole Ranch History Museum. And there are a few trails over there.
Right. Now, the museum is only open seasonally when they have staff or volunteers available. So if that's something you want to see, you might want to check and see if it's going to be open. But further east, and well, actually northeast on this main highway, you'll come to the McKittrick Canyon day use area. Now, this is only day use area. They lock the gate at night, but this is a gorgeous area, and we did a really pretty hike there.
We were in that part of the park in our October trip.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a beautiful area for fall colors. And about 2 miles in on the McKittrick Canyon Trail, you'll come to the Pratt Cabin, which I thought was interesting. Wallace Pratt built this stone cabin back in the 1930s as a vacation home.
Yeah, and then in 1963, he donated the cabin and 5,000 acres of his land to the National Park Service, contributing to the creation of the national park in 1972. So, Cassandra, this is a great trail because you can hike for whatever distance is comfortable for you. So you can hike to the Pratt Cabin. We continued on to the grotto, and the grotto is the open face of this small cave, and it's a really pretty little spot. There's some, you know, rock benches and picnic tables, and it's a good spot to have a picnic. And then if you go a little further, you come to the Hunter Cabin. This is a structure that was once a hunting retreat and a ranching operation. And then the trail even continues further if you want more. Now, we thought the grotto was a good turning around point because round trip, it's about 7 miles. So kind of the perfect length of hike for a lot of people.
Yeah, we were also trying to keep our distance from a fifth grade field trip.
Oh, that's right.
Of kids.
I forgot about that.
That seemed to want to be wherever we were. And so, yeah, at the Grotto, we had lunch and we headed back.
Right. So there's some suggestions for Guadalupe Mountains, Cassandra. It's a cool park. It kind of reminds me, the landscape reminds me a little bit of Big Bend, don't you think?
Yeah, it does. That's an interesting park, and I don't think they get a ton of visitors. So that's one that's probably not terribly crowded.
That's right. And, you know, if you're trying to decide between McKittrick Canyon and Guadalupe Peak, the way the ranger described it to us on our first visit when we were asking her which hike we should do, she said, do you want a pretty hike or do you want a strenuous hike? And that kind of sums it up. However, you know, that Guadalupe Peak is kind of the signature hike, and there are some stunning views from up there.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend the Guadalupe Peak Trail. Okay, Karen, do we have any other questions?
We do. This next one comes from Jason in Jacksonville, Florida. And he wrote, hi, Matt and Karen. My wife and I are traveling to the Colorado National Parks this summer, and I'm a little bit worried about getting altitude sickness. Do you have any tips to avoid this?
Yeah, I had a lot of altitude sickness years ago when we were visiting all the national parks for the first time. I don't know what triggered it other than the altitude. I know that a lot of times the effect is due to dehydration because you're at altitude and you're getting more dehydrated than you realize.
Right. And so one of the most important tips is getting used to the altitude gradually. So we're going to assume that you're flying in and out of Denver. And if you could stay in Denver for at least 24 hours before you head to the parks, that would give your body time to adjust to the lower oxygen levels there. Because when you go to Rocky Mountain National Park, for example, the lowest point in the park is about 7,600 feet. And when you get up to the Alpine Visitor Center, you are at almost 12,000 feet.
Yeah, I think the tip of acclimating gradually is a good one.
So if you look at the Rocky Mountain National Park website, they talk about altitude sickness. And what that looks like for a lot of people is shortness of breath, as well as headaches, fatigue, loss of appetite, nausea. And it's not uncommon to experience this even with a simple walk, and even for those who are really fit. So besides, you know, giving your body time to adjust, they are suggesting that you don't plan any major hikes during your first couple of days. And so their advice is take it slowly and listen to your body.
Yeah, and another park that doesn't seem like it's that high in elevation, but it is Black Canyon of the Gunnison at the rim of the canyon. It's 8,000 feet.
Yeah, that's surprising.
Right. So they also suggest, you know, spend at least one night at moderate elevation before, you know, coming up to the park. And here's another tip, which I haven't seen before, which is you can hike during the day up in elevation, but try to avoid sleeping overnight at a higher elevation than you're used to, or at least you've been acclimated to.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. They say never spend the night more than 1,000 feet higher than you did the night before. That's probably a really good tip that I wouldn't have thought of.
Yeah, if you follow that tip, then you're going to acclimate gradually. Also, you need to drink water. They say if you're thirsty, that means you're already dehydrated.
Right.
So a lot of times, especially at altitude, you're gonna need to drink even though you're not thirsty. Now, some people can overdo this, and we've seen and heard about, you know, people on desert hikes or like in the Grand Canyon, they're worried about dehydration. They drink too much water. So you have to be careful with that also.
And here's the thing too that they say, and I think this makes good sense, is they say to never ignore a headache. So if you have a headache, you're going to want to treat that before going any further. And if you can't treat it, you are already too high and you need to go back down. So I think that you're, Jason, you're right to be a little concerned about this ahead of time coming from Florida, because besides those two parks, you know, you've got Mesa Verde, which is at an elevation of between 7,000 and 8,400 feet.
Yeah. And even Great Sand Dunes National Park, it's at an elevation, at least the visitor center there, it's over 8,000 feet.
So our best advice would be to talk to your doctor ahead of time, because there are medications that you can bring with you that will prevent this acute mountain sickness. And they will also shorten the time it takes for you to get used to the high elevations. So, you know, we cannot dispense medical advice here.
Oh, we can't? I thought all those years of you studying to become a doctor, you can't.
Legally, we cannot dispense medical advice, but your doctor can. And especially, you know, your doctor is going to know about your particular medical history and situation. So definitely, definitely talk to your doctor.
And I did get a prescription from my doctor years ago.
And it did help.
And it did help.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
Also, this is common advice. Don't drink alcohol or do heavy exercises the first couple days that you're at high elevation, particularly above 8,000 feet. That is an important one.
Yes.
I mean, the alcohol generally is going to accelerate the dehydration.
Well, for sure. Yeah. So definitely look into that because it can ruin a trip for sure if you or whoever you're traveling with gets this altitude sickness. And one more thing that we have been hearing a lot about lately is motion sickness and about how so many people apparently have been getting sick on boat tours, you know, tours like Dry Tortugas and Kenai Fjords.
Yeah. I had that issue too. Now, what I did was I would take Dramamine if we went on a boat, and that helps a lot, although it makes me drowsy. Another tip for motion sickness on a boat is to turn sideways to the direction of motion. And I know that sounds like an old wives' tale, but if you shoulder into the direction of the boat, your inner ear can handle that motion a lot better.
Are you dispensing medical advice without a medical license there, Matt?
I'm dispensing old wives' tales without a license.
All right. So if you are going on a boat tour, you know, you have no idea ahead of time how rough the lake or the ocean might be. So also talk to your doctor ahead of your trip. And it would be a good thing to have something in your backpack or in your purse or whatever that you could take if you or people you are with are starting to throw up or get sick.
And shoulder into the direction of the boat.
Shoulder into the direction the boat's going. All right, there you go. So Jason, good luck. Sounds like you're going to have a really fun trip hitting all those parks.
Okay, Karen, is that it for
Oh, no, Matt, we got a few more.
All right.
Okay, this one comes from Shane in Athens, Georgia. And Shane wrote, I am just getting started visiting the national parks, and I would eventually like to see all of them. Could you talk about some of the mistakes that people typically make when planning their trips so that I can make sure I don't repeat them?
We now have a pretty good edited short list.
We do.
Of the mistakes people make and how to avoid them, because we get this question often.
And some of these are mistakes we made as well.
Right,
so.
And continue to make.
Right, right. Okay, number one, and this is might be the most common one we see, is that people plan their trips to certain national parks at the wrong time of the year, when this park might be too hot. Like, let's say they're going to go to Death Valley in the summer and do all kinds of hiking when it's going to be 120 degrees.
Yeah, or the park roads aren't open yet. Like Glacier National Park is one that people say to us, we're going to Glacier National Park in April. What should we do? And our advice is go to a different park.
Right.
Because
right.
Going to the Sun Road is never open in April.
Well, and the hikes are all under snow.
Right.
So make sure that when you're going, what you want to do is accessible.
Yeah. And number two, which used to not be on the list at all, but now you have to check to see if the park requires a permit or a reservation, like a timed entry permit.
Right. And so many parks are going to that now. It's really becoming something that everybody needs to be researching. Another mistake is not checking the park's website frequently. What we talked about at the very beginning of this episode, to see what's closed. You know, maybe you're going to go to Wind Cave and you think you're going to do the tours. And now because the tours are closed, you can't do that. And not only do you want to check it months and months and months ahead of time when you're planning, you want to check it the day before you go to see if a tree fell and there's a road closed, or maybe there's a wildfire that cropped up.
Yeah, yeah, really. I mean, a month before, a week before, a day before, all of those, because things change. Mm-hmm. And the park website is the best place to get that information. And another mistake is not planning far enough in advance. Mm-hmm. You might think you're planning ahead of time, but unfortunately, it's popular as these destinations are, a lot of times you have to plan 12 or 13 months ahead of time to be able to, you know, maybe get the reservation or get the lodging that you want.
it's sad that a lot of times you can no longer be spontaneous like that because you just won't end up with a place to stay. So another one would be trying to do too much in one single trip. So not only can that be exhausting, but I think oftentimes people don't realize how long it will take to drive from one destination to the next. You know, you might look at a map and it says 60 miles, but that 60 miles is a dirt winding road going over mountain passes.
Right. It could be 60 miles at 15 miles an hour.
Right.
And
right.
Sometimes you just can't tell that by the map or even reading blog posts. You know, there's nothing worse than getting fatigued by the places that you go to. And then you're in these beautiful, incredible places. And it's like, I can't look at one more tree. I can't look at one more spectacular canyon, you know. So every person, every family is different. Some folks like to do things, you know, all day long from dawn to dusk. But
And, you know, that's a really good point because I think that's what a lot of people struggle with, including us, is how long do you budget for each park? And, you know, it's tough. I remember the last time we were in Crater Lake, we were sitting around having a cocktail in the Crater Lake Lodge and we struck up a conversation with a couple next to us and they said they were there for 1 week. And we kind of talked later about, you know, in our opinion, there's not enough to do in Crater Lake National Park to stay there a week, but maybe they like to sit in a rocker on that front porch and read a book, which is perfectly great and wonderful. And so it just depends on what you want to do, and everybody's different.
So try not to plan too much for one trip.
Well, yeah, we always plan too much. And then what happens is, and Matt does most of the driving, so he'll drive 10 hours in a day, and then we'll get to our hotel. We'll have, you know, we'll have a day in a place, and then the next day we're driving another 10 hours. And it is exhausting, and it is too much time in the car.
So, and I get cranky.
And yes, you do get cranky.
So a couple of other things that people should watch out for is there are often a lot of really interesting destinations on your way to where you're going.
Sure.
That you should stop at. I mean, Devil's Tower is a perfect example. We'd go back and forth to the Black Hills many, many times. And finally we realized, well, we're not that far from Devil's Tower. We should go see that one time. And now we go every time.
Right. And you know, when you're in Utah, there are all kinds of great state parks and Bureau of Land Management sites. And I know we hear all the time from people on social media when we'll post, you know, a picture of something and they'll say, oh, I missed that when I was in, you know, the park next to it. And so, you know, definitely check out what is surrounding the park that you're going so that you didn't go all that way and you missed this other really cool thing.
Yeah. And then finally, not researching which parks are dog friendly or not. There's a reason why some of the trails don't allow dogs, and there's a reason why some do allow dogs. And the National Park Service, they have their reasons, and we don't always know why those are, but you do have to follow those rules.
Well, sure, and it is confusing because every park is different as to where you can take your dog. But we've seen it a lot where people, they don't realize that, especially in the West, you cannot take your dog on the trails in almost every park. There are a few exceptions. And so they go on this epic, you know, this epic trip in an RV, and they have their dog or multiple dogs with them. And they're very disappointed when they get there. You know, in the summer, you can't leave your dog in an air-conditioned vehicle of any kind. So anyway, just for everyone who's traveling with a dog, of which there are so many people, right? Just make sure that you know ahead of time where you can take your dog so that you're not disappointed.
That's right. Okay, Karen, let's move on to our next question.
All right, this is the last one, Matt, and this one comes from Annie in Liberty, Missouri. I saved this one for last.
Okay, what do you got?
I can't wait to hear what you're going to say about this. All right, Annie wrote, my husband will be retiring at the end of this year, and I'm worried about what this will do to our relationship. We're not used to being together 24/7, and I think we might get on each other's nerves. I'm curious about how you manage to work and travel together and stay happily married. Or has it been an adjustment for you, too?
Well, okay. So
choose your words carefully.
First of all, Karen from Seattle, Washington. Oh, no, I mean Annie from Liberty, Missouri. Yeah, this, I don't know. I mean, I have no advice. This, I would, my only advice is don't do it.
Like, don't find do another, what? Tell your,
tell your husband to find another job. A lot of danger zones. No, I'm just kidding. Look, it hasn't, I'm not sure we have advice on this because it hasn't been a problem for us, but I'm not 100% sure why it's not a problem for us. I mean, we are doing things that we really enjoy all the time. I mean, there are times when we travel less because the weather's bad everywhere, and so it's just not worth, you know, trying to travel, and we get more cabin fever, but that's not so much, it's not like we're getting annoyed with each other. We're just kind of tired of being stuck at home.
Right. You know, it is a huge adjustment. And we went from, you know, when Matt was working in the corporate world, not only was he, did he have a very demanding, more than full-time job, but his office was in Chicago and we lived in Seattle. So Matt would literally fly on Monday mornings to Chicago and come back Friday afternoon. So we weren't even together during the week.
Right.
For a couple of years. How many? 5 years?
Yeah. I thought that was more stressful, way more stressful than us being together every hour of the day.
You know, I think part of the issue is it's a bigger picture of what are you going to do in your retirement issue than it is, you know, maybe a relationship thing, because hopefully your husband has some ideas of what he wants to do in his retirement, you know, as opposed to just sitting on the front porch in a rocking chair. Because I think that if you can plan and do activities together, it might open up a whole new world for you. And here's the thing, Annie, since you're listening to our podcast, I'm assuming that you like to travel and go to the park. So maybe if your husband isn't a fan of this yet, maybe you could incorporate him into that.
Yeah, no, I think that's great advice. I think you should find things that you both like, and you should find things that just you like. So a good combination of interests that you have that you can, you know, do on your own, and it's your own special thing, and then common interests and activities. I think if it's all one or the other, all you just have your thing and he has his things, I don't think that's healthy. And if it's every single thing you do, you're doing it together, I think that can be unhealthy as well. So a good combination. But we have heard from a lot of people who go into this stage of life and they really want to go to the parks and really want to hike, and their spouse does not. And sometimes it's with men who decide that they want to golf every day, and they don't want to hike, and they don't want to travel. I tell you, if you get them out on one hike, it'll change their mind. And we have seen this happen with friends where all they want to do is golf, but then we take them on a hike. So we go to Palm Springs, and they golf every day. Then we do one day of hiking. You know, and a few years later, they don't even bring their golf clubs anymore.
Right.
And so I think if you just ease people into the activity, sometimes they'll discover it on their own.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good point, because I was not an outdoorsy person at all until 15 years ago. I think it is life-changing if you can just get that person out there to experience it for themselves. You know, it is all about compromise on both ends. And so, you know, maybe you start with when he's retired, you know, what does his fun trip look like? And whatever that is, let him plan it and you go joyfully. Maybe there's hiking stuff around there. And then you plan a trip and you just sort of find your way to a common ground. So that would be a good way to start. I also think that you asked about our working together. I think one thing that we realized pretty quickly is that as far as the work goes, so we're talking about writing books and the podcast and things like that, we learned to treat each other more like co-workers with that kind of level of respect than husband and wife. And I think that's been key, because when we treated each other as husband and wife and tried to work together, there were hurt feelings on my part.
Not on my part.
No,
my feelings never got hurt.
You know, you wouldn't necessarily talk to a coworker the same way you would your husband or your wife. And so we have made a switch to we talk as coworkers. And don't you think that that's made a big difference?
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's really good marriage advice. Always talk to your spouse as if HR's in the room. and then maybe you get along better.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that. But I do think, you know, I have a lot of girlfriends, Annie, who have felt the same way that you do. Like their husbands were getting ready to retire and they were nervous about what that was going to look like and how that was going to affect their routine and what they liked to do. And of course it will. There's no getting around that. All of a sudden, he is going to be home with you all the time.
I would suggest trying to write a book together. That will that would really help the transition from working life to retired life.
Yeah. So look, there's a lot to navigate and it's not always, you know, we're not saying it's going to all be smooth sailing. One thing we have noticed though, out of everything that we do together and all the time we spend together, our best times, the times when we are most happiest and we get along the best, is when we are out on a trail.
Right. Sometimes it's stressful to do all the planning and all the driving and getting there and finding the lodging. And then you got to find the trailhead. And it's like a quarter mile down the trail. It's like, okay, yeah, we're finally where we should be. And so, yeah, that's a good sign that we should keep doing that.
Yeah, I mean, you'll navigate through it when you see what it looks like. But yeah, I think the key things are find activities that you can share together, travel, go on some trips together, treat each other with respect of a coworker. And you know, hopefully this is going to be a really joyful time for you guys.
And hopefully you won't need to get HR involved. All right, Annie, thanks for the question. And that's going to wrap up this episode of Mailbag.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in today. If you have a mailbag question for us, please email it to us at mattandkarensmith@gmail.com.
And this year, National Park Week is April 20th through 28th. And we're working on a special National Park Week episode coming out on April 18th.
That's right. And you will not want to miss it.